A lot of us wonder what happened to all that time we used to spend reading. And a popular culprit is the internet, getting sucked into some kind of online vortex where time disappears. But if that's you I'm describing, is it possible that what you are doing is reading? If those links you're clicking on are think pieces on politics or parenthood, food or feminism, are those essays? And are those links on social media just a new table of contents? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about how we read, write, and consume essays today. And we'll get expert recommendations for some of the best ones out there. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. I'm here with the bibliophiles, Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library, Mark Luce of Barstow School, and Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, a freelance book critic and writer for the Huffington Post, among others. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hi. Good morning.
So, Katie, as a librarian, you talk to a lot of people about what they're reading and how they're reading. Talk to me about this moment for the essay or think piece.
Well, those pieces, short reading, long reading, I talk to readers who tell me that they have short bursts of time in which to read. And yeah, a lot of folks are finding their reading on the internet. That's a really good way to think about it, is, you know, the internet is a table of contents for a lot of different essays and think pieces and other short things. A recent Pew study found that print readers want to spend less time on their devices, and that commuter reads are picking up as where people are finding short bursts of time in which to read. And a recent article said that if you've got a 15-minute commute or less, people are more engaged in reading poetry. And if you've got a 30-minute commute or less, then folks are more inclined to read essays or short stories. So when people tell me, well, I don't have a whole lot of time to read, then I drive them to websites like Longreads or Longform.
Tell me about those.
Well, Mark knows about them, too. We both use that. But Longreads is a website that I like a lot because it pulls together some of the best essays out there in print and sometimes on the internet, and you can just they break it down by topics: sports, essays, politics, memoir, science, and I love it for that. Longform.org and longreads.com, they're similar in aggregating really wonderful long pieces if you like long form narrative journalism. And Mark reads them at night, he was saying, and I tend to read during the morning because my brains die at night.
Mark, tell me, first of all, as a reader, what you enjoy about this form and how the internet is maybe affecting your reading habits.
I think that, I used to always read novels before I went to bed. And what I would find is basically that I would stay up too late. If something was very good, then I would just stay up and keep reading. And what I found is that by reading shorter pieces, although to me, like a long form journalism piece is a short piece. So like a 15-minute read to me is a short read. So what I found is that I teach creative nonfiction at KU and have for, I couldn't even tell you how many years. And I'm always looking for something else to show the students and kind of get them in the habit of, you know, it used to be reading magazines, but we don't really read magazines anymore. So this is about the closest that I've found. Longform.org. Mm-hmm. And it's done by the writing program at the University of Pittsburgh. And they basically have, every day they have basically a best of the web. And so it'll be stuff from the New Yorker. It'll be stuff from Oxford American. It'll be stuff from Topic or Savour. It just varies, and the topics are all over the place, and you can narrow it down to whatever you want.
So with the topics being all over the place, I mean, I think that reading essays, a lot of people have read essays for a long, long, long time, but it might be kind of a new experience for people who are diving in for the first time thanks to social media or the internet. And what do you think it is that ties all these essays on topics ranging wildly from, like, you know, the politics of our day to the nature of existence? You know what I mean? What ties together this whole genre?
I think there are a couple different things. Like, when I read at night, I'm not necessarily always reading the personal essay, right? Sometimes I'm reading maybe a profile, or maybe for reporting, or maybe actually someone who's quite a stylist that I enjoy reading, kind of like Ian Fraser. Like, I'll read whatever he writes. He wants to write a laundry list, I'm happy to read it. But I think it varies for folks. I think that one of the things that nonfiction, like personal essays do, I think, is that they kind of tend to bum people out, because they tend to be sort of exploratory and often looking at kind of a dark side of someone, like raw, revelatory in a way. And so on something like long form, you get sort of variety. So I want something techie, I get something from Wired. I want something erudite, I get it from The New Yorker. But I think it's, you know, what I'm not reading are short pieces on Slate, you know, like those that people call think pieces.
Okay, so explain what that is.
Well, to me, it's I don't know exactly. I guess it's one of those things, like, you know it if you see it, or you know it if you read it. Someone sort of like talking about X topic in a somewhat intellectual fashion.
I think that the term think piece has been around for a long time. I'll say, when I graduated from journalism school, which was a long time ago, in 1971, we were assigned think pieces. We read think pieces. I think the first time think piece was used as a term was in 1936. So, yeah.
Explain what it is.
I mean, to me, it's just not standard factual. It has analysis. It has reflection. It has chewing on the meat of a subject. More than an effectually based piece.
You know who I think of is the old R.W. Apple political pieces from the New York Times, where he's a reporter, sure.
Right.
But he gets to sort of weave in kind of analyses in a way that's way more exciting than, like, the president spoke today.
Can you give an example of something that he wrote that stands out to you as?
I read him sort of in a collection, so I read sort of his work in the 70s when he's talking about Nixon, and just kind of holding court over that. He's one of the first guys that I ever knew sort of as a journalist who kind of had the right, or had earned the right, to do what he did.
Well, I mean, I think you could argue that The New Yorker is basically made up of long think pieces. That's what it's all about. But they're factual, but they also have reflection, a point of view, not an aversion to calling out certain behaviors, and newspapers have become smaller and more condensed. And the Kansas City Star does have an in-depth page in which they do, writers are given more space, but think pieces in newspapers are fewer, for sure.
You know, we've talked about a little how social media has maybe influenced the way people read essays or think pieces now, and why they do, how maybe even commute length is affecting that. But what about... It does seem like in some ways we're in kind of a moment of social upheaval, and I wonder if that also increases people's interest in just diving into topics that are swirling around. You know, I mean, there are pieces on topics like race and gender that entire communities of friends are reading and talking about, and that is something I don't think I've experienced before in my lifetime.
Well, social media is just making it very easy to share those pieces. I have friends who say they get all of their news and long-form reading off of Twitter, recommendations from journalists that they're following. I have friends who also say they're getting their news off of Facebook. That's great, and we're probably, in our communities, we're all reading the same piece, so we can talk about it on social media. It's important to consider who your community is that you're getting those recommendations from, because you might just be doing a preaching to the choir kind of reading, book discussion reading, where everyone says, I loved it, or yes, I agree. And so if your community on social media is a lot of like-minded folks, you might not be getting the think pieces or the pieces that challenge your thinking that you want and deserve.
I think that's a very good point, Katie. And I tend to, I'm going to take a contrarian viewpoint here. I subscribe to two newspapers. I subscribe to The New Yorker. I mean, I'm a paper person. I want these publications to stay alive and in print. And those are the sources of the places where people aggregate. And I like aggregators. Like Ann Friedman is a great aggregator. But I do find that I think the internet for me, and I'm on Facebook, not on Twitter, it has influenced my reading and my attention span a little bit. I have to admit it. It has fractured it a little bit.
Reading online will do that because we are, when you, reading online on do that because we are also bombarded. While you're reading that article, there's things in the sidebar that are popping up. There are ads that are targeted to you. There are other little Google ads that are disrupting the text, which is disrupting your reading, and that disrupts your concentration. That is one of the reasons people still gravitate towards print. I'm really glad that I've always said print will never die, even when I heard, oh, the book is dead and dying. No, it's not. Not even on life support. People want books because books are uninterrupted and there's no ads. And I read print magazines as well because I want to give myself the break from reading on my tablet, on my phone, or on my computer. I want to make it easier on my eyes.
Well, let's dive into recommending some essays, long-form journalism, think pieces, that whole gamut of stuff. Katie, talk to me about where we've started here, which is with the think piece.
Well, I'll tell you about a piece that really made me think and that I keep on thinking about. And that's my definition of a think piece, a piece that stays with me, that makes me think about things in a different way. And this piece is about 2 years old. It's by Catherine Schultz. It was in, I think it was in The New Yorker in 2015, and it's called The Really Big One. And this is about the earthquake that is supposed to hit the Pacific Northwest pretty much any day now, any time now. But what I loved that Catherine did in this piece called The Really Big One, and you can find it online, is she breaks down the earth science. She breaks down the history of the world, and then she talks to emergency service personnel, and she talks to government officials, and she talks to preparedness folks. She talks to folks who are survivalists, and she talks about what would realistically happen if the big one hit the Pacific Northwest. And I was fascinated. I don't want to call it train wreck writing. It's not train wreck writing, but you cannot look away or stop reading this piece that Catherine Schultz has written as you're going through. And you start to think about climate change, and you start to think about science, and you start to think about how well prepared is our government for a disaster of that magnitude. So that's a piece that I'm still thinking about. It's also a piece I'm still recommending when people ask me for something long form that's good to read. I'm like, read this. It's got all the pacing of a great adventure. It's got all the detail for science nerds. And it's got a lot of humanity for people who like character-driven stories.
And we're going to move on to our next critic in a moment. But I'm curious about Los Angeles Notebook by Joan Didion.
Oh, this essay is so old. And I discovered it in a reader that I used to teach Comp 101. Los Angeles Notebook is about the Santa Ana winds. And Joan Didion writes, I think Mark is nodding. I think he's read it too. Joan Didion is writing about the weather changes in Los Angeles when it's the season for the Santa Anas. She's like, there's one line in the piece where she writes about women test the knife blades of knives, women who are bullied by their husbands, and that the rise of murders goes up in Los Angeles during the Santa Anas, that babies fret and cats yowl and scratch, and everybody just feels on edge. And she writes about what happens to you inside. And then she talks about the science of the chemicals, the chemical imbalance in the air, what's happening with the weather and how it affects your mood. I found that fascinating. I think I read that in my early 20s in a comp class. And thereafter, it was one of the pieces I always assigned to my students.
So that's Los Angeles Notebook by Joan Didion.
Yes.
And so let's move on to Mark. Mark, you are recommending a bunch of individual essays here. How about Eula Biss, The Pain Scale?
that's a really interesting piece. This is a very good writer. She basically, in this piece, she suffers from chronic pain that they kind of can't find out what's wrong. And the doctor says, it's not that we don't believe you. And so she uses the actual pain scale, which is like rate your pain on a 0 to 10, I think it is. And she goes through the numbers. So she starts at 0 and then talks a little bit about the number 0, what 0 means, and does that kind of for each number, and then weaves her own story of chronic pain throughout it. I find that the piece, I've read it several times now, I find it to be very moving. There's self-doubt in there. She wonders, like, am I imagining this? Is it really not real? Are the doctors helping me or not helping me? And then she also sort of takes time out to look at different kinds of scales. So there's the Beaufort scale that is hurricanes. She looks at the little sad faces and happy faces that they get kids to point at when they're sick. It's just a really kind of fascinating look at pain.
You know, so that's The Pain Scale by Eula Biss. What would you say about her writing style for people who have never read work by her?
I would say that at times lyrical, at other times sort of matter of fact. She also has I don't want to say totally mischievous, but maybe impish sense of humor. Like there are a couple kind of dark takes in the piece. You know, I haven't read her widely. But I found her quite enjoyable.
I read a book by her called On Immunity, which is...
That's what I was trying to think of, what her book length work was, yeah.
Yeah, it's a short book length essay, one essay though, and it is about vaccination. And it's not about the controversies around vaccination, it's about whether there's a primal inborn fear of like shots, and goes back to the myth of Achilles, you know, like that's an immunity story and that's a vaccination story, that he was dipped in something to make him immortal except for his what is now the Achilles tendon. Right. And it's this really kind of beautiful raw meditation, and it's something that took this controversial topic and actually just made it something that you could think about without all of that noise around it.
Well, I think, you know, that seems to me sort of key. I mean, one of the things that Joan Didion tells us in at the start of the White Album is that we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And that in a world where, you know, I sort of think of it as like the sports talkification of like all things, where it's like if you don't have a take right now about, you know, Tillerson out at State, like what's your take? What's your hot take right now? And it's... that doesn't give you time to think, right? And so people come up with like, oh, let me think about this sideways, or let me think about it slant, instead of taking the time to actually consider, okay, what is a vaccination? What is immunity? And I think what you're suggesting is that Biss does that quite well. And I think that good personal essays, right, or, quote, think pieces do that. Annie Dillard's Total Eclipse is one where, you know, I had never had any desire to see an eclipse until I read that essay.
What's it about? An eclipse, obviously.
It's about how
does she approach it?
She approaches it. They, her, and it's like a pretty straightforward narrative. They're going out to
Oregon. I've read a lot of Annie Dillard. I have not read that, but that was one that was passed around a lot, obviously.
Yeah,
recently because of the eclipse.
I mean, it's the story of going to see the eclipse, which is a particular way of talking about an eclipse. It's the human experience of watching one.
But once it goes dark, the sort of the feeling that she had, and sort of being completely lost and kind of terrified, and sort of the awesomeness of it, that's what appealed to me. Unfortunately, I had to work that day, but my wife and son got to go see it. So next time.
Well, I'm going to go to Jeffrey Ann Gowdy in just a moment, but I also reached out to the staff here at KCUR because, as you might imagine, public radio journalists read a lot of essays and long-form journalism. I want to share a couple of those recommendations. Erica Hunsinger is the new editor of Harvest Public Media, and she recommended a great sports piece from ESPN magazine. It's a piece called When Winter Never Ends, about a Japanese baseball player, Ichiro Suzuki. Did I pronounce that
Ichiro.
Right? Okay, good.
Good one.
During a precarious time in his career, he's 44, he hasn't signed on for the upcoming season, and it's this masterful piece of writing by a guy named Wright Thompson, who used to work for the Kansas City Star. Katie is waving a book in my face.
I love sports writing. That is some of my favorite nonfiction writing. And I brought The Best American Sports Writing, edited by Howard Bryant. It's 2017. So, yes, Erica, sports writing.
Wright Thompson's a really good, he's a really good writer.
Yeah, it was, I read it this morning, actually, based on her recommendation. And it is this compelling moment of doubt for someone who is, you know, an
arguably the best hitter ever in baseball. Yeah.
Well, okay, so that comes highly recommended. It's called When Winter Never Ends. And our web editor, CJ Janovy, is recommending Poor Teeth by Sarah Smarsh, a Kansan who's made it pretty big in the last few years.
Great essay.
It's, yeah, tell us about it.
It's about being poor and having bad teeth.
Yeah, I mean, it starts with a line I'll never forget. I'm the bone of the bone of them that live in trailer homes.
I thought it was an excellent piece. I mean, it's sort of launched her on her niche that she's found in long-form journalism about writing about the class in which she grew up in. And I had never read anything about teeth and social class.
Yeah, and that perfect teeth are a marker of someone who could afford
orthodontia.
Yeah.
Excellent. And Sarah is now a fellow at the Shorenstein School at Harvard, developing a podcast about the Midwest. But
oh, really?
She's done some great long-form journalism. Yeah.
Well, CJ is also recommending a few pieces of music writing, including a piece called Saying Goodbye to the First Good Old Boy of American Pop. It's about the country musician Glen Campbell, who apparently critics never liked, but I guess he spent some portion of his career languishing in Branson. So, yeah, I've started that piece, and it is really fascinating. It's in The New Yorker. Jeff, give us one of your recommendations.
Okay. Do I have time to talk about the book and a couple of essays? All right. Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. This isn't a book that I reviewed, but it's a book I picked up off the must-reads table at Barnes & Noble, and it is a must-read. I think she's a fantastic writer. I would basically walk across broken glass to hear her speak. She's incredible.
Why?
My favorite essay in the collection is about her life as a competitive Scrabble player. And she is a creative writing professor at Purdue, but when she first taught at Eastern Illinois University, she was terribly lonely. And one of her colleagues invited her to join their monthly Scrabble club. And so she dives right in and goes to a tournament, and she is the lowest seeded person at the tournament because she's never been at a tournament. She says she has hubris that she makes up for her lack of self-esteem, but she wins the tournament, and humiliating losses follow. But she writes with such good detail about this tournament world, like people who wear fanny packs without irony. She herself now has a carrying case that she slings across her shoulder so she can rock the tournaments. It's just full of wonderful details.
Why is it called Bad Feminist?
It has textures. It has this essay has footnotes. It's called Bad Feminist. There's two essays that end the book in which she talks about her reluctance to call herself a feminist because she considers herself not a bona fide feminist. She sometimes cries at work. She reads Vogue. She can't repair her car. And then she talks about her contradictions, but she still embraces the term. And in that way, she invites people in. It's a fantastic essay.
Well, we'll hear more of Jeff's recommendations when we come back, and yours. It doesn't matter whether your favorite essay or collection of essays was online or in a book, whether it was published recently or centuries ago. Call 816-235-2888 with your recommendation. I'm Gina Kaufman, and the Bibliophiles will be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're talking about essays, think pieces, and long-form journalism with the Bibliophiles. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the piece of writing that really got you thinking or just captivated you with its beauty. 816-235-2888. The bibliophiles are Katie Stover, Mark Luce, and Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. Hi again, everyone.
Good morning.
We were just hearing a recommendation from Jeff, and that was Bad Feminism by Roxane Gay.
Yeah, Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. And I'll just say that the most painful essay in this collection is the most personal. And it's about a pivotal event that sort of divided Roxane Gay's life into before and after. She was in middle school. She had a crush on a boy. They went on a bicycle ride. They went into the woods. They went to a deserted cabin. All of a sudden, there are other boys there. They're handsome. They're popular. She is shy, painfully shy. She's gang raped. And that, this is way before Me Too, very personal. I know from other things she's written and her interviews that at that point she began eating a lot and tried to make her body a fortress. And it's a very painful and a very relevant essay. So
that's, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, that, so this is Bad Feminist, not Bad Feminism, by
Roxane Gay. I hear she's wicked good on Twitter, but I'm not on Twitter, so I can't say.
She is.
And Katie, you've brought in some books that made you fall in love with this form, you're saying.
Right. I didn't really learn to like the essay until I had to teach Comp 101. And I had to find
had
essays.
To.
I had to teach Comp 101, and I taught it for several years at Emporia State University. And I kept the two readers that I used as textbooks. And one of them is called The Harvest Reader, compiled by William A. Heffernan. And then 75 Readings in Anthology. And this is actually a desk copy. It's my very first advanced reader copy of anything. Mark's laughing.
But tell me more about your experience of falling in love with this form through these books.
Yeah, and it was these books. And these two readers, they're ancient. And I still reread essays out of these books, essays that I taught, essays that I just loved. And I gravitated towards essays that had a lot of vivid description, a lot of colorful adjectives and witty wordplay, which led me to all the sports writing that I like to read, which is why I brought Best American Sports Writing for 2017. And they're probably less think pieces, because what I learned in these two readers was how to appreciate a format and the structure and listing of qualities and adjectives. And here's where I learned to love expository writing.
Can you give an example of a piece in that book that just like blew
yes.
your mind?
From The Harvest Reader, I just thought it was one of my favorite pieces to read and reread is, it's really ancient. It's Garrison Keillor's How It Was in America a Week Ago Tuesday. And what he does in this piece is makes fun of those, remember those big books that Life magazine put out, A Day in the Life of America? And he just makes fun of what's going on in America on a Tuesday. He doesn't even mention the day. A couple of us were sitting around in the United States of America one night not long ago when we got this idea for a magazine article. We would call up housewives, farmers, doctors, white-collar workers, black people, students, town officials, teachers, urban planners, airline spokeswomen, gay persons, historians, and small children in California, Louisiana, Orlando, and Kennebunkport. And it just goes on and on and on to list all these unusual things. And there's one line from this essay that I constantly quote, my friends will recognize from me saying, people are sheer, stark, raving, crazy nuts, quote me. And that's just funny things that people have said. And it's just the way Keillor lists everything, because this is an essay of descriptors and lists. And it's the way he put all the words together that I loved. You're just learning about housewives cracking eggs and someone hitting their thumb with a hammer and someone writing policy in D.C. And it's all of that. What's happening in America on a Tuesday, from the mundane to the profane. So this piece I
okay.
love.
So the names of the two books that made you fall in love with essays once again, Katie.
Oh, The Harvest Reader, by edited by William A. Heffernan, and 75 Readings in Anthology, and that's from McGraw-Hill. Good luck finding them. They are both wildly out of print. And if you still own a copy of The Harvest Reader, you should check what it costs on eBay right now.
Well, so let's go to our listeners. Bill in Leawood is calling with a sports piece to tell us about. Bill, hello.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Good. I normally read a lot of clinical papers because I'm in the medical business, actually opening a new clinic on depression and mood disorder. And so spent a lot of time reading that kind of stuff. But this article was on the NFL.com network. And I only would go there because I want to know something quickly about the Kansas City Chiefs. And this is about Alex Smith comparing...
The football player, not the KCUR reporter, I'm guessing.
No, no, I know him too. So, and this was talking about the decision. I don't know how long you guys have followed the Chiefs, but way back when Alex Gerbach, when Gerbach and Rich Gannon were here, and they traded Rich Gannon to our nemesis, the Oakland Raiders, and he ended up taking them to the Super Bowl the following year. And so the article is about comparing that time. Is this another bad decision? And, of course, the decision is not just the coaches, because we've gone through 10 coaches since then. It's on NFL.com, and was talking about that pivotal decision the Chiefs made this year to let Alex go to the Redskins, and then going with a new guy. And three-quarters of my family and friends love Alex Smith, or upset about him leaving, and a few of them were like, it's time to go, we're never going to win with this guy in the playoffs. And the whole article was kind of sort of comparing that time period, and it was a good essay, so I thought I'd recommend that.
Well, thank you, Bill. And, thanks so much. You know, this brings us back to this idea that a moment of change and upheaval is an interesting moment to explore in essays, and that might be part of why people are furiously passing this kind of piece around right now, whether it's in sports or in some other area of our culture. But Katie, you've been singing the praises of sports writing. Can you talk a little bit more about what it is about sports that maybe lends itself to these kinds of, I don't know, human dramas?
Sports writing has all of that. It has the human drama. It has lots of colorful characters. It has lots of niche sports where people can learn a little bit more about a segment of the world, a culture that they'd never heard about. Some of my favorite sports writing isn't about the game or the players. It's about the people on the periphery. It's about the fans. It's about the people that keep the ballparks clean. It's about the ball boys, the ball girls. It's about the little girls that skate onto the ice rink and throw the flowers. It is about the drama. That's important. And it also brings up history.
Well, I want to jump in here because we have Lindsay from Prairie Village also recommending what I think is sports writing, and it's something that Mark is also recommending. That is Roger Federer as Religious Experience by David Foster Wallace.
It's the best. I would contend that this is one of the best essays that's ever been written.
Bold statement.
Well, Roger Federer is the best tennis player that's ever played, right? I mean, I think there's like actual factual evidence to support that. He's won more majors than anyone else. Right. So who do you get to write about Roger Federer? Right. Everybody's tried to write about him, but the way in which Federer plays is really kind of something that people had never seen before.
So is this like everyone's tried to photograph like the Golden Gate Bridge or something?
The way I look at it is you've got the best tennis player and then you get the best stylist to write about that player. And the thing is what Foster Wallace does with his pen is not dissimilar to what Federer does with his racket. And so the pairing of the two is absolutely insane. When I first read that, I almost fell over. I'm just like, I didn't know you could do this in an essay about tennis. He's got footnotes. He's got all kinds of things. He talks about angles. He talks about geometry. He talks about wind. He talks about hair. It's just absolutely first rate. And I would say, again, for me, it's like that's one of the best essays I've ever read.
So that is Federer as Religious Experience by David Foster Wallace. You're also recommending another one of his essays.
Oh, Consider the Lobster, which is great. I mean, he was such a wonderful nonfiction writer. Everybody thinks of him kind of as a novelist, but his nonfiction, I think, is almost better. But Consider the Lobster, he was sent up to Maine to a lobster fest to do basically kind of like a piece about the lobster fest, and really has no opinion about sort of lobsters or the ethics of lobsters, and basically kind of stops and is like, what's going on? And so he looks at sort of the myths that we tell ourselves about, like, oh, the lobster doesn't really feel pain, or the lobster doesn't do this. And he sort of explores all of those in the context of this huge lobster festival. And so he's asking people, like, hey, is it really ethical? And they're like, who are you? Like, what are you doing here? It actually made me stop and at least think before I ate lobster. I didn't mean that I didn't eat the lobster. It just every
you
time
thought
I,
about it
every
first.
Time that every time that I eat lobster, I do consider the lobster.
Nice. Okay, so that's David Foster Wallace. Jeff, share one of your recommendations.
Okay. Well, again, I'm a book person, paper person. So I brought in Ta-Nehisi Coates' book that was published last year, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. And his book that was published in 2015, Between the World and Me, really altered the way I looked at the world. I mean, it was personal, it was profound, it was political. This is more, I'm not sure if the right word is intellectual, but more scholarly. This book is comprised of pieces that he originally published in The Atlantic. And he references all kinds of scholars, including University of Kansas, Dave Rediger, who's head of the American Studies Department there.
The founder of the controversial White Studies.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. And each of these 8 pieces is introduced by a little introduction that's sort of a bloggy type of personal introduction, and I love those. And the book,
what are these essays largely about?
The arc of the book is his Coates' development as a writer, but also Barack Obama's 8 years in power. And he writes about Obama, Barack Obama. He writes about Michelle Obama. He writes about Bill Cosby. Some of the little introductions put the pieces in context, like he has to sort of amend his perspective about Bill Cosby, given what we know more about the man now. But my favorite piece in the book doesn't have an introduction, and it's the epilogue. It's the last piece. It's called The White President, and it's about Donald Trump. And basically, Coates maintains that Donald Trump is president because he is white, that he ascended to power because of a huge backlash against Barack Obama's presidency, or a white lash, if you will. And he sort of says, you know, as a black man, you have to be twice as good to get anywhere. Well, as a white man, Trump proves you could be half as good to get anywhere. He's very strong. And it's a very powerful book.
The name and author of this book again?
Ta-Nehisi Coates' We Were 8 Years in Power.
You have just a little while left to recommend your favorite essays, whether they're recent or you've known about them for decades. 816-235-2888. You can join our bibliophiles. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we will be right back. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with the Bibliophiles. Those are our book critics, and we are talking about essays, think pieces, long-form journalism, pieces of writing that really got you thinking about something in a new way or just captivated you with their beauty. And we'll be hearing some more of our listener recommendations at 816-235-2888. We'll also have a list of all of our Bibliophiles recommendations, because we sometimes don't get to all of those. Those will be online later today, along with some KCUR staff recommendations. So keep an eye out for those. Katie, take us to Awake in the Dark by Roger Ebert.
I brought that just as an example of this is a collection of the best of Roger Ebert, probably America's premier writer on the American cinema. And this is a collection that I pulled really quickly. It's 40 years of reviews, essays, and interviews. And I had started to read his piece on Pauline Kael, In Memoriam. And it's just lovely. And I'm looking what drew me to this book was not just his criticism, but he writes his wonderful essays in the back, under a segment called Essays and Think Pieces. And he talks, and here are some of the titles that really pulled at me. And I didn't get around to reading Legacy of Star Wars, but this is a good time to probably pull that essay out and read why Star Wars is still such an important part of American culture. But he's got wonderful pieces, The Case for an A Rating, Why We Should Change the MPAA Rating System, A Pulitzer for the Movies, Why Not Offer a Pulitzer Prize for Writing a Really Good Movie, and then the piece that I read and loved the most, In Memoriam by Pauline Kael. But I offer books like this to people with a specific interest in a subject, and they do want to read shorter pieces. And so I say, you know what? It's an essay collection isn't just everything under the sun, like Best American Essays, and I can talk about that later. You can pick up a book by a writer who's writing a lot in a subject area that you like, such as Barbara Kingsolver, Roger Ebert, and Roxane Gay. So that's why I brought that one, Gina.
But I like that you brought in reviews, which in the best sense are essays. I mean, if they're done well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are a form of essay.
Well,
he's
a phenomenal writer.
Yeah. As was Pauline Kael.
Really good essay will make you think. And that's what a really good piece will make you think. That makes it a think piece. Criticism, personal essay, long form journalism, that makes a think piece. Something that stays with you after you've finished the last word.
Let's hear from one of our listeners. We've got Judy and Lawrence on the line. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How about you? What do you want to recommend?
Good. Well, two things, actually. I called because the current New Yorker, I mean, who can talk about their favorite essay? There's so many wonderful essays. But the current New Yorker has an amazing piece by Catherine Schultz. It's called Home Invasion. It's about stink bugs. And this is an incredibly serious issue, actually. I mean, these critters eat absolutely everything. And so they're a terrible blight on the landscape, and they're really taking over. But it's hilariously funny. So the way she writes is really wonderful. The other person I wanted to recommend is Sally Tisdale. She has an old book called Violation, and I couldn't find my copy quickly. She has an amazing piece in there about being a nurse in an abortion clinic.
Yeah, that piece is called We Do Abortions Here, which is a title
That's
you
right.
don't forget
yeah.
either.
That's right, yeah. So I just wanted to recommend those too.
Well, thank you, Judy.
I have seen that Catherine Schultz piece. People are sharing it all over the place on Facebook about the stink bug.
And she brings up that, you know, an essay on a serious piece can be funny. I mean, can you think of other examples of people who bring unexpected humor to their writing? Essayists?
Barbara Kingsolver does it in a small, quiet way.
Well, Nora Ephron was a public wit for sure.
Talk to me about Nora Ephron.
Nora Ephron. I love Nora Ephron. And I read her forever. And her first piece that really brought her attention was A Word About Breasts. Because back in the day, people did not write about stuff like that. Of course, now they really do. And
she was a screenwriter. She wrote, I mean, her big hit was When Harry Met Sally.
You know, when I cut my intellectual teeth, I read Nora Ephron in Esquire, which at that point was a magazine that published think pieces by Joan Didion, by Nora Ephron. She's better known now for her movies, When Harry Met Sally, you know, You Got Mail, etc., Silkwood. But anyways, she had a voice, just like Joan Didion. And her voice was, she was on the inside of things, but she was also on the outside of things. She was poking fun. I thought she was absolutely brilliant writer, way too soon.
Yeah, late. I mean, I'm not sure if this was the last collection she had out or not, but again, a title that really grabs you, I Feel Bad About My Neck.
Yes, I read that. That was her next to last collection. Her last collection was I Remember Nothing, which was so poignant. And when I was reading it, I thought, this is so poignant. And there was an essay in there, Things I Will Miss. And at the time, she was struggling with cancer, which she was keeping a secret. And then she died.
Her younger sister wrote the very first essay I read and absolutely loved in the Sunday New York Times. Delia wrote How to Eat Like a Child, and I cracked up so much at the dining room table reading that while my family was eating. My mom said, finally, put away the newspaper and get back to eating.
Yeah, all the Ephron sisters became writers, and they all wrote memoirs. So.
And Mark, speaking of funny writers, you are just generally recommending David Sedaris?
I don't know how you couldn't. I think that I like his earlier stuff better, and I don't, it's at least like one of those like rock snob guys. It's like, well, you know, his first two albums are really good. But his first two albums were really good.
And what are those?
The first one is Barrel Fever.
Yes.
Which there he's kind of, it's a different Sedaris than you know, because he kind of has these fake, like he has one where he's married to Mike Tyson that is absolutely hysterical, and they're giving.
So it's like a fantasy? I don't know if you'd call it that.
It's a send up. And he's talking, I think he's talking to People magazine. It's only like a 3-page piece. So there's Barrel Fever, and then there's Naked, which I'm actually teaching on Thursday. That's his second collection, and it is wildly entertaining. Really kind of recollections of his family and his family life, which is just kind of like zany.
Is that the one in which he has the essay about when he licked the doorknobs when he was a child?
I think that's in there.
Yes.
Zany
is the perfect word for David
Sedaris. He goes to see Planet of the Apes movie. His dad doesn't come to pick him up for a long time. He works as a candy striper. And then in the last one, he goes to a nudist colony and has adventures at the nudist colony. But I think that everything he does is pretty good. But I think that there's something a little more kooky or zany in his first things that isn't.
I think what I like about the later stuff, honestly, is that it is not as kooky or zany. That it has a little bit more of, I don't know, substance.
A little more introspection and gravitas. He's growing. That's what makes David Sedaris a wonderful essayist to follow from his early career to now. Because like you, Mark, I love those two collections, and I reread Holidays on Ice every December. Yeah.
You'll laugh harder at the early stuff, but
you will. But if you're going to read David Sedaris and you really want to dive in, you should start early and then watch his progression as a writer. It's wonderful. It's fascinating to go on his journey of growing as a writer and digging deeper and talking about really difficult subjects and putting a humorous spin on them.
His recent piece in The New Yorker about his mother struggling with empty nest syndrome, basically, and who went from one cocktail a day person in her painful descent into alcoholism, I thought was incredible.
Well, so there you have it. Varying reviews on which part of David Sedaris' career is best, but it seems like unanimous recommendation to read David Sedaris if you haven't. Let's talk to Chris in Prairie Village. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. And thank you for a wonderful show. And I too love David Sedaris. He is a personal essayist, so he does a marvelous job and a very authentic job of describing himself. But I'd like to mention somebody who hasn't been mentioned, I don't think, today, and that is John McPhee.
Oh, yes.
M-C-P-H-E-E.
Absolutely.
And he throws him. Thank you. Yeah, he's just a magnificent writer, has such a facility with the language. But he takes subjects that you would think would not be particularly fascinating, like oranges, for instance, and can do, 3,000 words when you think, 500 words, what more could he have to say about oranges? But it is gripping. It is compelling.
What more could he say about oranges?
I did.
He could probably write 30,000 words on oranges.
I could not do him justice. I commend his essay on oranges. There's a John McPhee reader, which is a collection of his stories, and a John McPhee second reader. His first piece was, you mentioned David Foster Wallace, who did some great things on tennis and other sports.
Yeah.
McPhee's first piece was about Bill Bradley, and it's called A Sense of Where You Are.
Yeah.
So Bill Bradley, who went on to become senator from New Jersey, was a basketball player at Princeton in the 1960s, and just a magnificent piece. So I really think you cannot go wrong with John McPhee.
Well, thank you, Chris. And, Jeff, before we go, you are recommending a collection on some of the great female essayists.
Yeah, this is forthcoming from Grove Press, and I have a review upcoming in the Minneapolis paper on it. And basically, Michelle Dean, who won an award for her reviewing last year and is a good critic and also is a contributing editor to New Republic, chooses some of the writers that we've been talking about, Nora Ephron, Joan Didion, Renata Adler, Pauline Kael, great essayists who were sometimes writing criticism, sometimes just writing straight essays and books. She puts them at the center of our intellectual life.
Any final words before we go that anyone's dying to get in?
That orange piece by John McPhee is Citrus sinensis.
That's the name of it?
Yes, I just found it.
John McPhee's piece on how he structures, how he learned to structure stories is absolutely fascinating. And Donald Hall's 100,000 Straight Nails is a wonderful essay.
I think John McPhee is the first long-form journalist that I really followed. He's in The New Yorker, and then his stuff was put into books, as many New Yorker writer stuff is.
And then How to Write a Rotten Poem with Almost No Effort by Richard Howie.
Wow. Okay, I think we could have gone for 2 hours, but our time is up. Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library, thank you. And Mark Luce, thanks for joining us from the Barstow School.
Thanks.
Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, freelancer, thank you. This has been great.
Good to be here.
They are the Bibliophiles, and they join us once a season, so you can catch back up with them in the summer, and you can listen back to this discussion, get the list of all of our critics' recommendations and some KCUR staff recommendations at kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. With help from intern Matt Groby, I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.